The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
City. It's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, in the second half of our program, we're going to take a very sobering look at the hard science pertaining to anticipated climate solar flare activity. That's when it is estimated that nearly 1 billion people will die. Life as we know it will simply change so radically. Just imagine that you are now involved in the lower Ninth Ward when Hurricane Katrina is hitting. Multiply that times 10,000. That's what's coming at us. My guest, Larry Joseph, a seasoned investigative journalist, has been writing on science for more than 25 years for the New York Times, Discovery, etc. And he also wrote a book, Apocalypse 2012, An Investigation into Civilization's End. And he has also written about Aftermath, A Guide to Preparing for the Survival of Apocalypse 2012. So this isn't about voodoo science. This isn't about some religious prophecy or the Mayan calendar. This is a hard science information emanating from NASA. Please listen carefully. Your life and survival could depend upon it. Now, also today, a commentary on Obama's original sin against morality from Andrew Levine from Counterpunch. I'll also be giving the latest about Nancy Pelosi. Do you remember when Nancy Pelosi, at the last minute, after saying she would absolutely support at all cost the public option so everyone could be insured, and then she backed out? Well, I've just come across a little piece of information that explains why she backed out. We have a lot to share, a lot of it on the environment, a lot on health, with time for you to give your comments. Let's go to the latest. As many people who've read the article on the fluoride fiasco from my website, it's posted on my Facebook, on GaryKnoll.com and ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, there is an enormous amount of quality science showing that fluoridation does not prevent tooth decay, as we've been told, and should not be used as a mass medication, as it has been, but that it does cause any number of diseases. That particular paper, written with the detail for scholarship, has been used by lawyers and public advocates to get fluoridation out of their water supply. Here is the latest why we should be concerned. This is from Nev Arnell, Natural News. Quote, North America's water fluoridation debate, battleground Austin. As a result of a year-long public outcry against water fluoridation in Austin, Texas, the city council held its second public meeting on the issue, which attracted a standing-room-only crowd. Water fluoridation is a policy endorsed by numerous global health organizations, most notably the North American Dental Association and the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Controversy surrounding the practice has grown in recent years. However, as an increasing number of scientists and health professionals argue that fluoride in drinking water causes many negative health effects, especially when looked at beyond dental health to the impact of the whole body. Areas in the United States and Canada, most recently Calgary, with 1.1 million people have already stopped fluoridation, and U.S. cities such as Austin, Denver, Boulder, which are considered the fluoridation issues currently, may follow suit. This caused a domino effect across North America and bring water fluoridation to a halt permanently, according to Fluoride Action Network Executive Director Dr. Paul Conant, who we've had on this program. So now they're doing this whole effort in Austin. That's the battlegrounds. On one side, we have Dr. Conant, who is Professor Emeritus of Chemistry at St. Lawrence University in New York, and the author of the case against fluoride, and author of many papers. On the other side, you have some dentists. So now we have more than 100 national and international health science and professional organizations recognizing and endorsing fluoridation for water. Yet outside of that, the vast majority of people and scientists are against it. Why would someone be for water fluoridation? Well, what we have found is that it's not because there's any conspiracy. It's just because they have not read the literature. So here's what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting to people in this audience, download the Fluoride Fiasco, which has been recently updated. It has all the science from all the peer-reviewed literature showing why fluoridation should not be used and is dangerous. My suggestion is that you start a campaign of sending this to everyone you know. If you're on Facebook, send it to every one of your friends on Facebook and ask them to send it to every one of theirs. Because everyone in America drinks water. Everyone is exposed to fluoride. And therefore, they should know the dangers. This is something we can do. And looking at it from a very positive point of view, wouldn't it be nice to know that you're contributing to making a social issue in your life changeable? This is something we have the power to change because we can get referendums and then vote against it. And before, for a long time, we didn't have the science collected in one place. So they would trump up some statements, oh, it's irresponsible not to fluoridate, you know, you're causing tooth decay. Not any longer. We have all the good science on our side. It's all in this one article. This article has been used to solve fluoridation, so send this everywhere. Even send it to your dentist. In fact, I would suggest that any holistic dentist listening, and we have many, Dr. Elmire Gadol, one of the leading holistic dentists in the United States, and get this to the Holistic Dental Association and have them send this to all their members, who in turn should send it to their patients. I'm starting by today sending the article to 45,000 holistic physicians and clinicians in the United States. 45,000. Or about 99%. So let's all help today. Let's all get behind this, because we shouldn't have one city, Austin, in Texas, that has a very progressive community, I might mention, working on behalf of everyone else. We should all be working together on this. So go to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, go to GaryNull.com, download the article, The Fluoride Fiasco, with all of its scientific references, and start sending it out, saying, please read this. This is all the science in here is orthodox, all of it's mainstream, and it shows why we should not be fluoridating. And I'm hopeful that people who were not aware of these facts will then change their mind. Next up, we all want to have food in our body that prevents cancer. Well, there's one food that could if we ate it more often, but we don't. Leeks. L-E-E-K-S. Leeks are very similar to onions, but they're actually in the asparagus family. And this is very big in the Mediterranean diet. Any of you who have ever been in the Western Mediterranean, Italy, Spain, Greece, Portugal, France, know that leek soup is very common. And they also will braise leeks and put them into a salad, much like they do fennel, which is also very healthy. Well, they found that leeks contain a compound which not only promotes your heart health and lowers your blood pressure, but also can prevent carcinogenic development in the body. It inhibits it. These are called camphorol, C-A-E-M-P-F-E-R-O-L. These are chemicals that are good for you. It can also help prevent prostate cancer and colon cancer. And leeks are very low in calories, so they're excellent. And you bring your water up in heat and not to a boil, and then you add your leeks and just stir them around in there. I would suggest adding some miso and some mushrooms, and then you have a whole anti-cancer soup that you could use. They're also rich in zeaxanthin, and vitamins, and but leeks historically have been used in juices too. You can juice the leek. It helps with anemia. It's a blood builder. It has an easily absorbable form of iron. It detoxifies the body, cleanses the colon. It's high in potassium. It lowers your blood pressure. And pregnant women can benefit greatly from eating leeks or consuming the juice because of their folate content. And that can help prevent brain defects in babies. And along with phosphorus and magnesium, folic acid is also essential for maintaining healthy nervous system. And it's got a very good fiber content, which reduces bloating and improves digestion and repopulates the good bacteria. So have some leeks in your meal. Also, for those of you suffering from COPD disease, which a lot of people do, that's chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, they're now looking at natural techniques to eliminate or lessen the mucus, the wheezing, the shortness of breath, and the chest tightness, all of which in the coughing are symptoms of that condition. It's caused also by irritants and pollution, not just by smoking, and it's really debilitating. And I'm suggesting taking those nutrients in that enhance oxygenation of the blood. Vitamin E, tocotrienols, coenzyme Q10, these are all important. And also, finally, drinking tea daily is as good as water. Let me quote this because this is a major study published in the British Journal of Nutrition. Here's what it says. A study has found that drinking 4 to 6 glasses of tea daily is as good as a liter of water for keeping yourself hydrated. The finding disproves the idea that regular tea drinking can dehydrate the body, and the research also found no negative health effects in drinking that amount of tea. So, therefore, have the tea. I'm suggesting green tea, red tea, oolong tea, black tea. It's all good because it has the polyphenols that help you against cancers. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you, and especially all of you listening in Ireland and around the world. We have people listening almost in all the countries of the world. More than half of the audience are listening outside the United States. To answer that question, gee whiz, wonder why Nancy Pelosi did not stand up and say we will have a public option, which she originally, as well as Obama, planned to do. Well, how about this? Within 3 hours of saying she would no longer support the public option, this invitation went out. I got a copy of it. How about this? Quote, "You are cordially invited to a reception with Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, 6:30 to 8 p.m. Thursday, September 24th, at the home of Steve Elmerdorf, 2301 Connecticut Avenue. If you're a PAC, 5,000 individuals, $2,400. To RSVP, call this number. And Steve Elmendorf is a lobbyist for United Health Insurance. Isn't this wonderful? We finally get something. It's prima facie evidence, irrefutable. Nancy Pelosi sold out hundreds of millions of people so she could have the health insurance industry fundraise for her so she could get reelected. Well, just a little details. Oh, and did I also mention that the latest research shows that, quote, detailed reports show more drug industry ties to medical societies. And then it goes on to talk about how when doctors were told by the National Lipid Association that there are medications that would help lower your elevated lipid levels, yeah, well, how about natural vitamins and diet. Green juices do it. Oh, no, drugs do it. Now we just found out that $112,500 was given by the makers of the drugs to the society, medical society. And if you want to see the biggest sellout of all medical societies, the American Academy of Pediatrics. And they're the ones recommending all those vaccines and how every kid in America is just, well, what are they? They're just in need of ADD and ADHD treatment. Commentary time. As we know, it is commonplace in world politics for domineering powers to justify themselves by proclaiming their own essential goodness. The American empire is exceptional, however, for declaring that its goodness consists in its implacable adherence to the norms and morality of the rule of law. Now, given the facts, the irony inherent in this contention is staggering, as any reasonably informed and fair-minded person would attest. However, it's been so far so long that it hardly bears notice. Lately, though, the extent of bipartisan acquiescence in this self-representation has taken an unusually appalling turn. The efforts of the United States NATO to kill Gaddafi and his family are arguably par for the course, as is the assassination of Osama bin Laden by Navy SEALs, Barack Obama's murder incorporated. But the level of bipartisan support for these and other targeted killings, and in the case of bin Laden, the triumphalist adulation that temporarily united liberals and conservatives, marks a new low. This is why it is particularly apt now to reflect on what really is exceptional about the American empire. From time immemorial, ethical codes and legal systems have evaluated actions and situations in ways that depend upon the identities of the actors involved. It's only with the rise of distinct but related conceptions of equality, equality of personhood, equality of citizenship, that an impartial or agent-neutral conception of right conduct and of equal justice under the law has taken hold. In ordinary speech, morality has many ill-defined and sometimes contradictory meanings. In philosophical context, however, the moral point of view designates a standpoint of impartiality or agent neutrality from which agents deliberate about what they ought to do. This purchase on what morality is advances understanding and helps make sense of vague and conflicting claims. In a world order comprised of vastly unequal constituent parts, it is almost impossible to sustain the moral point of view. The American experience bears out this expectation, yet it is the norm in our political culture to identify our purported goodness with our morality and lawfulness, and to promote obliviousness to this plain fact. As with many other tenets of modern secular thought, the moral point of view was first broached in a theological framework. Thus the golden rule, the injunction to do unto others as you would have others do unto you, a deliberative standpoint attributed to Jesus Christ himself, suggests that the differences between oneself and others should not matter in cases where right conduct is the issue, that only commonality should be taken into account. Presumably, the relevant commonality in the minds of thoughtful people 2 millennia ago, as well as similarly thinking people today, was the equality of souls, their equal importance in the world, their equal importance in their faith. But there's no need to invoke dubious metaphysical or theological entities to grasp what the moral point of view involves. The core idea, the rational kernel inherent in the idea of the golden rule deliberation, is the moral equation of persons, the principle that everyone should count the same. It took almost 2 millennia for that thought to take on social and political content. Thus, in the eyes of the medieval church, everyone, regardless of social status, was of equal concern to the deity. But no one in the sway of that belief thought this implied equality of treatment by society's basic institutions. That notion, equality of citizenship, is not much older than the French Revolution. The idea that laws apply equally to all, regardless of differences in status or power, is a modern innovation. notwithstanding its archaic roots. Thanks to slavery and its aftermath, and to the class inequalities, the United States has hardly lived up to the ideal of equal justice under the law, even within its boundaries. But the reality does something sometimes approximate the ideal. And there have been moments, just brief moments in our history, when we seem to be on course for advancing that notion that we are equals. The immediate post-World War II period was such a moment. Through the United Nations Charter, the Nuremberg War Crimes Trials, and in other ways, the U.S. helped to advance notions of universal human rights and international law. By any pertinent economic or military standard, American power was supreme. But the United States declared itself subject to the same laws as other states. In practice, though not in theory, that moment passed almost immediately as America assumed an imperial role on a global scale. Again, for a brief period of time in the mid-1970s, after Vietnam and Watergate, something like the post-war spirit reasserted itself, at least to the extent that assassination was officially proscribed as a tool of foreign policy. That moment passed even more quickly, now with our national security state led by a Nobel laureate who is comfortable using unmanned killer drones and who calls upon practitioners of the dark arts of special ops to execute the empire's business. Assassinations become an instrument of American foreign policy to an extent never has it been before. Thus, we do unto others that which we never countenance others do unto us. How has it come to this? How can such pragmatically violating morality coexisting individuals with the idea that we are exceptional among nations for championing morality and law? Denial and hypocrisy play a role, of course, but the main thing is that we have managed to convince ourselves that we are good guys, are at war with incarnations of evil itself, that our enemies fall outside the moral universe to such an extent that against them anything goes. More than Gaddafi or Saddam Hussein, and certainly more than Slobodan Milosevic, Osama bin Laden was a perfect candidate for this project of self-deception, a villain straight out of central casting. For those in charge of the predations of empire, he was a good godsend. No wonder that our rulers were content that he remain at large for almost a decade after the deed for which he is charged. Charged but not convicted. It has never been entirely clear just what bin Laden's role in the events of 9/11 was. Had he been brought to justice, as genuinely moral leaders would have demanded, that would probably have become clear. But now that Murder, Inc. has dumped his body in the sea, we may never know. No matter, bin Laden's well-constructed, transient villainy was, and still is, a serviceable pretext for the longest war in our country's history. There are doves who now believe that with bin Laden sleeping with the fishes, Obama will soon bring the Afghanistan war to an end. But these are the people who believe in the essential goodness of the regime and its leader, and so they are capable of believing anything. Outside the perfid imaginations of our most gullible compatriots, the Afghanistan war was never about expunging evil from the world. It wasn't even about revenge, though that primitive motive did play a role in winning popular support for Bush's machinations. The neocons saw Afghanistan as a dry run for their project for making the Middle East safe for American corporations in Israel. But even when they were calling the shots, the main thing was always the need to maintain credibility. The United States went to the war in Afghanistan to demonstrate that it must be feared, that if it is struck, it will strike back a hundredfold. This is how gangsters think. And it is telling that on this point, there has always been a bipartisan consensus. Our most prominent doves, Obama, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, when he was running for president, Howard Dean 4 years earlier, were entirely on board. Obama deserves condemnation for presiding over a Clinton-like restoration, for enhancing toxic Bush-era policies on privacy and civil liberties, and above all, for earning the confidence his Wall Street patrons bestowed upon him. But his original sin was to let Dick Cheney and George Bush, off scot-free and to hold no one accountable for the war crimes, crimes against peace, and crimes against humanity perpetrated under their regime. This is why to this day no one of the Wall Street criminals was brought to justice, even though they brought the financial world to ruin. In Obama's America, you're too big to be brought to justice. And if you are, that could shake the system to its foundation. The rule of law in America is just for the little people. And despite Nuremberg and the UN Charter, their counterparts in the international arena. Obama's enemies are just the latest in a long line, and the applause he has garnered for wielding them boldly, he is saying, is distressingly familiar. But as the endless wars of Cheney and Bush initiated grind under Obama's willing stewardship, it is becoming increasingly evident that what is at stake is nothing less than the rule of law and the demands for morality itself. It has come to this because the good guys are at war with transcendent evil. As I said, the irony is staggering. And Andrew Levine is a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies. Your turn to speak out and give your point of view. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome, all of you. I'm Gary Nall. A real quick special for you today. Coenzyme Q10, a big 120 milligrams, 60 soft gels, 50% off. That's the high-quality, highly absorbable Coenzyme Q10, also known as ubiquinone, an essential part of the mitochondria, the energy-producing unit of the cells of the body. It is one of the most important antioxidants you can take, and that's how we help our cells be protected. I sure take my Coenzyme Q10. I take it 3 times a day. But I'm putting it on sale today, 50% off. But I'm giving you a second choice in case you have your Coenzyme Q10. I'm also adding in my special formula I've created called the Anti-Inflammatory Special Joint Support Formula. In this I have... And this is also a buy one, get one free. Plus, I'm throwing in a $40 DVD, A Natural Approach to Pain. So helping you get rid of pain, $40 free with this one. And then this, you're getting hyaluronic acid. You're also getting the philodendron bark extract, white willow bark extract, grape leaf extract, devil's claw root, decursinol, and cat's claw. It's a vegan capsule, it's kosher, and you're getting also high amounts of glucosamine sulfate, which is an amino acid sugar that occurs naturally and is synthesized in the body from L-glutamine and glucose. And it stimulates the manufacture of the glucoaminoglycans, which are vital components of the cartilage that is necessary for healthy joints. And as we age, we lose our ability to manufacture an adequate amount of glucosamine, and there's no food source available. And also commercial sources of glucosamine are from the exoskeleton of certain shellfish, but there's natural sources. So now, there's nothing like this out there on the market. I get enormous positive response to people who have used this. This is the joint anti-inflammatory joint support glucosamine sulfate plus. And again, you're getting that at half price. So we have two different specials, Coenzyme Q10 and my anti-inflammatory glucosamine sulfate plus. And you get, with either one, you get pain, the documentary, A Natural Relief. That's a big special. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. We're going to go to our guests in about 5 minutes. But first, we're going to take a few calls, and we're going to say hello to Elizabeth in the studio. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gary. Hello. We have an email from a gentleman. His name is Anthony Variano. He's from Hoboken, New Jersey. I don't have time to read the whole email, but this is the main points of it. He says, recently, I've been faced with a challenging personal dilemma regarding this idea of supporting our soldiers, yet denouncing the military-industrial complex and its blatant acts of aggression against other nations. This has come to a head for me since I recently learned that my niece has decided to attend West Point Military Academy, passing up other fine schools where she's received substantial academic scholarship to attend. I have a deep connection to my niece, and this decision has stirred up much for me. No one seems to be talking about the sacrifice of her liberties, his family, that is, the indoctrination process that must be undertaken, forsaking her individuality and the uniqueness in the name of I don't know what. I've lobbied hard to offer her another view, questioning her about the whole military piece to this equation, asking her if this is something she really wanted to get involved with. How could an 18-year-old know what she's getting into? The brutality of war, the politics and business of what drives these encounters, and the subsequent physical and emotional fallout from intentionally offering oneself up for these barbaric events.
Okay, I know where this is going.
Yes.
So let me give my suggestion on it. Let's summarize what he is saying. He has a better understanding of the consequences of war. She does not. Almost all young people going into conflict are doing so because some have a notion that it's heroic. More often than not, however, it is an advancement, it's a free education, it's an opportunity to get college paid for and see the world in ways. There's camaraderie, there's not going to be loneliness, lots of people, and you're secure in this. Now, compare that to people who may not have the money to go to college, or if they do go to college, they're just going to run up a debt and can't pay it, and then wouldn't be guaranteed of work when they get out. And then they're looking at a world that they don't know where they fit and seems to be ever more elusive for them to find the security they're looking for. What this young lady has not experienced yet in the propagandizing that occurs at a West Point or a Naval Academy is the reality of what happens when you interdict in another engagement. For example, recently I did a commentary written by Chris Hedges about a woman who ended up in the body bag detail, meaning it was for her to go in and scrape the brains off walls and clean up the mess and stick it all into a bag that was once a human being but is now just rotting flesh, and how she couldn't get the smell of the dead flesh off of her body, no matter how hard she cleaned, and how other soldiers didn't want to be around her because there was this superstition that if you're around someone like that, they'll end up putting your body in a bag. Or of all the post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, if this woman wants to see the other side of the equation before she makes up her mind, then she should go down to the east coast of Florida, near Cape Canaveral. There is a Bradenton, there's a whole community there of homeless vets, people who served in Iraq and Afghanistan. There's 16,000 of them. They live in the woods. They have no electricity, no plumbing, no water, no sanitation. They live in little pup tents. Many are alcoholic, many are on drugs. They can't afford medication, and they've been forgotten. They all have stories about their experience, what it was like and what they anticipated before they went over and what it was like when they came back. Unfortunately, these individuals who are the victims of war made it back. Society has no place for them. They don't have a happy ending. And because they can't be exploited, like Pat Tillman's story, the famous professional football player from Arizona that went out and then became anti-war once he was in Afghanistan and then was killed by friendly fire, and the general's clerk, the Secretary of Defense, lied about it and tried to make it look like he had charged the enemy and the Taliban to save his own soldiers and made him a national hero. All of that was contrived, much like Jessica Lynch's, you know, heroic efforts were all contrived. She never even fired her pistol. In any case, the government lies and lies all the time about such things in its pursuit to make someone a hero. But the government never gets all of its recruits and shows you two pictures. The picture of the person that's able to go to college, able to master a career, able to see some parts of the world, able to strengthen their body, able to develop some disciplines they might have had, all of which are positive. And then balance that to what happens when you see the person in front of you step on a landmine. and get blown to shreds. What happens when you fired a car because it didn't stop, only to find out that it was mother and four kids, all of whom killed, true story, because they didn't know what you were doing because they didn't speak English. You got to live with that. Easy to someone to come up and pat you on the back and says, wasn't your fault, just get over it. Well, try to get over putting a bullet into a young girl's head and see how easy it is to walk away from that. It's easy for Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck and many people to say, all of our brave men and women, but what about responsible for making decisions about the rightness of an action? If every person who served in conflict was given the ability to make a rational choice before they engage in that conflict about both sides of the equation, what happens when you put depleted uranium into an environment and you know that that depleted uranium is going to impact people there? You never talk about it. What happens when we blow up infrastructure that is necessary not for the military but for civilians? Like Clinton's Defense Department did in Iraq. Well, first it was Bush Sr., then Clinton, and 500,000 children die. Do we say that those children deserve to die because they're Muslims and will grow up to be, one of them will grow up to be the caliphate? No, they were just kids, just like kids anywhere. But Madeleine Albright, in an interview with Leslie Stahl in 60 Minutes, says, yes, it was worth it. Worth it for whom? Didn't help us win anything and didn't change anything. That's the callousness. So a young person going into the military should at least be given the opportunity to understand the full consequences of that choice. If they're not given the full consequence, and if the only time they find out there is an alternative consequence is when they're in the field of operation and they have to make life and death decisions and they have to live with the consequences, then we have not given them the true education that they deserve. We do a disservice then to them. Hope that answers the question.
Thank you.
Let's go immediately over to my guest who is standing by. I gave an introduction, extended introduction to Lawrence Joseph earlier in the program, investigative journalist. Nice to have you with us today, Lawrence. Hi, Lawrence, are you there?
Hello.
Can you hear me, Lawrence?
I can hear you.
Oh, good. You're in Southern California. And we might have just had a connection blip there. Lawrence, we're going to take a look at some of the hard science pertaining to the anticipated climate solar flare activity and the Elenin Comet and its potential effects. And I'm going to ask you to guide us in this, since you have been the author of a few books on the events that are possibly going to happen or likely to happen in the next 12 to 24 months. Now, my major issues, the recent warnings from NASA and the European Space Agency, otherwise what I would consider a conservative institution when it comes to forecasting, that gigantic magnetic storms, coronal mass injections, or CMEs from the sun, would create havoc on Earth. And there was also a 2008 report from the National Academy of Sciences on societal and economic impacts from space weather events. A Katrina from outer space, as physicist Michio Kaku says, well, when do we believe these storms will begin? When will they peak? What are the key triggers that we need to watch for? What is most affected? In other words, the power grids, the nuclear power plants, because all nuclear power plants run off electricity. If the electricity goes off the grid and the nuclear power plant's electricity goes out, what's going to have the water pumps pumping water into those spent fuel rods? How long would it be to normalize the society? I'm giving you my whole overview, and then I'm going to just keep quiet and let you spend the time answering this. And what are the repercussions leading to any form of civil unrest? And I was even given a prediction that there will be, from scientists in a scientific publication, that up to a billion people could perish because of the consequences of this event. Please take your time. You've spoken with a lot of people. You've been at conferences of scientists. And give us your best estimates of what we're looking at. The forum is yours.
Well, the change in my life, and I'm 57 years old, and I've never said this, never put it so dramatically. I don't believe in being hyperbolic was when, in December 2008, the National Academy of Sciences and NASA issued the report that you mentioned about the effects of severe space weather. And in that report, they concluded that 100 to 130 million people in North America alone could be without electricity for months or years as a result of...
Wait, how many people?
100 million to 130 million. Basically, the Northeast, the Midwest, and the Northwest are directly in the line of fire from solar blasts or coronal mass ejections, as they are known.
Northeast, Northwest...
And Midwest.
So you're talking about over one-third the entire American population.
Yes, and that's just looking at the consequences for the United States and Canada. You know, the rest of the world would, of course, not be immune. And no electricity, as is forecast to be the result of these coronal mass ejections, would mean not just no telecom, but no water or gasoline, because the pumps are electric. No refrigeration. Basic law enforcement and military security would be compromised. Electricity is the cornerstone technology of contemporary civilization, where everything plugs in. And without it, especially for periods, as they say, of months or years, civilization could well be brought to its knees. This is it. One cannot overstate the seriousness of this matter. Now, when I first heard about this, I thought, well, this is one of those hypotheticals that scientists like to toss out because it's dramatic. It also tends to gain them funding. I don't mean to be cynical, but we all, you know, have to make a living. So I thought, okay, if a blob of the sun falls and hits the earth, it's bad news, right? Is that what you're talking about? And no, they were very clear that coronal mass ejections that occurred in 1859, which is known as the Carrington event, and 1921, the Great Magnetic Storm, as they now call it, in 1921, were they to occur today, we would be looking at the worst-case scenario I described. They caused relatively little problems back then because there was no power grid in 1859, nor was there one in 1921. There was a society that had been largely electrified, but each city had its own generator. You didn't have mega voltages whizzing around the grid as you do these days, and transformers being the vulnerable points, you didn't have transformers. So this is an astonishingly scary scenario, particularly given that the next climax of solar storms is, by scientific consensus, due in late 2012 or early 2013. Now, that doesn't mean that's when it's going to happen. I mean, space weather is like Earth weather in that it's very hard to predict. I mean, it's a science in its infancy, and even Earthbound meteorology, which is not in its infancy, still gets things wrong lots of times. But we do know that the sun ebbs and flows in 11-year cycles, and the next peak of that cycle is late 2012 or early 2013. Now, there are scientists who will jump in right now who would say, yes, but the current cycle that we're in is remarkably low, and therefore we needn't worry about the next peak. Well, that's wrong. If you were to look at the cycle that led to the 1859 blast, the Carrington event, which is the mother of all blast, the largest one in recorded solar history, the largest one we know of, the cycle was almost identical to ours now. You don't need a big cycle. You just need one big storm. You don't need a snowy winter to have one giant blizzard. So, and anyone who wants to lull us into a false sense of security because the current cycle is lower energy than some that have been previously, is doing a disservice, a grievous disservice. When I first started writing about this years ago, and, you know, faced my fair share of derision or skepticism and whatever, it's, you know, it's part of the job, it's par for the course. That changed quite a bit in June of last year when the United States House of Representatives voted unanimously to take the steps necessary to protect the power grid from solar storms. Now, those folks won't cross the aisle to perform the Heimlich maneuver. And so when the Democrats and Republicans get together and vote unanimously to do something, you know, it's something to take note of. Of course, you know, in the bizarre ways that Washington works, the Senate stripped out all language regarding the power grid and solar blast, stripped it right out of their bill. So we never got where we needed to go. An odd circumstance that, where the House is unanimous and the Senate wouldn't even consider it. We could get into the theories as to why and how that happened. And I'm not a Washington insider enough.
No, I don't care. This program, it does not care about the opinions of politicians. We do not hold them in high enough regard to respect their opinion. We care about the science, all right?
Okay, well put and understood. I did manage to attend a 19-nation summit conference held at Parliament in London, where I was impressed, remarkably impressed with the level of scientific work and even the level of the politicians and the bureaucrats who attended, but we were all pledged not to discuss any of the details of what went on at that conference. It was 2 days. It was remarkable. It was incredibly scary. And all I can say is, and I mean all I can am able to say is, in my opinion, pray. There are, what's maddening about this situation is that there's apparently a way we can protect ourselves. This is not just a prophecy of doom. Just as you use surge suppressors to protect your computer or flat-screen television from power surges, it's a very common thing, and now they're usually built in, but you might have one of those strips where you plug into. So I'm sure most listeners would be familiar with this little bit of consumer technology. We can protect the power grid with surge suppressors. Let me describe to you basically how it works. It's pretty simple. A blast issues from the sun. Usually the northwest quadrant of the sun is where we have to keep our eyes on. It just so happens that blasts that come out, sunspots that occur on the northwest quadrant and blasts that come out of those sunspots on the northwest quadrant tend to hit the Earth. Not sure why, but that's where we keep our eyes on. Get hit by a lot of these, and normally the radiation, it's a big plasma blob, flies, takes a couple of days. Flies through the vacuum from the sun to the Earth and is channeled by the Earth's protective magnetic field into circles around the Earth. The Van Allen radiation belts are those protective magnetic spheres that keep the radiation from coming down to the surface. Every now and then, a blast is big enough, such as the one in 1859 or the one in 1921, to crash through this protective magnetic shield. The shields are down, Scotty. That happens every now and then. The shield simply can't hold to take the impact. What happens then is several volts per square meter of direct electricity go into the ground. It's not enough to harm us bodily in any way, but it goes into the ground and then comes back out, comes up and fries the transformers, which are the nodal points of the grid. If I had to say, the weak point of contemporary civilization are the transformers that hold the power grid together, because these things operate at extremely fine tolerances, and they can be disrupted even by just a couple of volts of direct current. And disrupted means not just that they flicker on and off. The copper windings of these transformers fuse, and you can't just send out a utility crew to repair them. You have to replace them. This is a problem, because they weigh over 100 tons apiece, the large ones, the ones that would do the most damage and the ones that are also the most sensitive to these impacts. They weigh over 100 tons apiece, and on the current world market, there's a 3-year waiting list for them, and none of them is made in the United States anymore. And to make things just a bit more dicey, we couldn't launch a crash program to just say, let's make 1,000 transformers and warehouse them somewhere, and then, you know, to protect ourselves as needed, because each one is programmed and constructed to the particular point in the power grid where it's going to be used. So it's not one size fits all, unfortunately. What makes things, if you have an absurdist sense of humor, funnier, is that the electrical power, the magnetic field that's protecting us and protecting our power grid, has just developed a gigantic pole-to-equator breach. There's a gigantic hole in the Earth's magnetic field. Now, this is not according to Larry Joseph, who heard it on some very, you know, sly source. This is according to a squadron of five, count them five, NASA solar research satellites called THEMIS, T-H-E-M-I-S. December 2008, they flew unexpectedly through this giant hole. They saw the magnetic field's density drop by 90%. The project leader for NASA on this was so astonished. And this is a quote. He said it was as though
you realize what you just said rewrites all nuclear physicists' projections and mathematical equations on this.
He was, yes, I know. It was so shocking that he said it was as though the sun rose in the west. And recall that they had five satellites returning the same data. So it wasn't just one wonky little satellite. You know, I mean, it was five of them. And it was that shocking. The project leader, that was a quote in science@nasa.gov, you know. Remarkable little article. Remarkable also that it hasn't been picked up more. But, you know, that's another discussion, the psychology of absolute terror and major events. But we have a very... very precarious situation, because we're definitely headed towards the climax of the solar cycle, again, late 2012, early 2013. The magnetic field that's supposed to protect us from storms that will issue from the climax of this cycle is inexplicably down. We have a power grid that is not only vulnerable, but that becomes more vulnerable with each passing year, because we run it at higher and higher voltages, which means the transformers operate at finer and finer tolerances and are therefore that much more vulnerable to these blasts. We have a solution. And one of the things that was noted in the U.S. House of Representatives bill was they came up with an idea to pass the cost along. It would cost $5 to $10 per household per year to protect the power grid. Not insignificant, but not that much, given what we're facing. And we have a technology that we believe will work, sort of just a surge suppressor the size of a washing machine. You know, I mean, it's a crude assessment, but that's basically what it is. We need 350 of these spread around the grid pretty quick. And we're not getting anywhere. We have valiant people trying, both scientifically and in terms of the politics, to do this, to save us.
Okay, let's just put this in perspective for a moment and then go forward from here. I'm going to ask my engineer the significance of this material is such I'm going to go 5 minutes into the next program, because I want to get some positive solutions here. My guest is Lawrence Larry Joseph. He is a 25-year award-winning journalist in science, nature, politics, New York Times, Discovery, etc. We're not talking myth. We're talking hard science.
Yeah.
But we're also talking what I call watching Katrina. I did a commentary after Katrina when we as a nation saw it coming, but so little was done that could have been done to have prevented people from being killed and property destroyed. I was appalled. It was as if we were in a virtual reality game and we weren't aware that we were in the game. We were watching it. And then one day we're watching people who had been watching it for five straight days on the roof saying, help us. So here we are again. You don't see this as front line headline news. You don't hear it being talked about. I've been monitoring all the programs. I haven't heard it on Fox or MSNBC or in the networks. Something's wrong when you have something that could do this much damage and no one even wants to broach the question. And part of it is what I feel is what Fritz Perl, the father of Gestalt, said, a fear of knowing is a fear of doing. Because at some point, if we know, here's what could happen. Well, what could happen is that all those individuals and corporations, water purification plants, nuclear facilities that are off the main grid could be disrupted anywhere from maybe as little as a few weeks, but that's very optimistic, to as long as a year or more. Okay, what does that mean for me? I'm in an apartment on the Upper West Side. What does that do? Well, how about you can't use your elevator, your air conditioner, your freezer? How if it's wintertime and if you have forced air heat, that isn't going to work. If you want water, that doesn't work. That works off a water pump. If you want to get out of town, you better have a full tank of gas and gas stored, because all the gas that goes from underneath in those 20,000-gallon storage tanks under filling stations in your car, that's got an electrical pump. Well, what about hospitals? Well, they've got 48 hours of backup emergency battery, but then everything else won't work. Well, heart-lung machines won't work. How about surgery? No lights? You're going to be relying upon the simplest of things. How about temperature control? No temperature control. What about environments that require temperature control? Well, you're not going to have any temperature control. Well, how about food? Well, take a look at Katrina or any other hurricane. For the first 2 days after a hurricane, you have no water and very little food. If it's a big deal, you don't have water or food for a period of time. Go to any country where they've had a major earthquake, there's no food or water at all. In fact, why don't you use Japan? Japan, a first world nation that for over 60 days still has not been able to replenish all the water and food in the environment where the people were living, as if even if having food, water was still adequate to what they needed. No, now we're knowing they shouldn't be in that environment at all. So we could be looking, since you can't get water or food to people, then what's going to happen? Well, you're going to use everything you can to eat. That can that you didn't think of eating of the beans, that might be a day's worth of food. What about water? Well, since we're not Barbados in some parts, and we're certainly not a country that encourages cisterns to collect water, then we're, like Bermuda, we're in trouble. Unless you have some water, and what if it's water that you're not going to drink out of a river, you're going to end up with schistosomiasis or something else. So we're looking at the possibility of hundreds of thousands of people having gross malnutrition and dehydration starting in about 2 to 3 weeks after this.
Yeah.
When food, and then you're going to have the criminal element. So what if there is some food? What if there's a warehouse with food? Well, those who have the weapons will get it. Who are the most likely people to contend for getting what supplies we do have? Well, why don't you go down to Haiti? Remember carefully my broadcast when I said that the earthquake in Haiti will be an enormous business opportunity for the five leading gangs that control Port-au-Prince. They will have the weapons and the power that anything comes in will go to them. They will put it in a warehouse, and then they will sell it on the black market. It's exactly what happened. So now you're going to have gangs, of which there are now 1.7 million, according to the latest FBI. By the way, that's up 300% in the last 4 years, and it's going to only increase. Now you're going to have the gangs controlling any place where there is a point of survival, water and food. It's not a person's home, domesticist at issue here. But how do you get to work when you don't have the gasoline? How do you turn on a television when it doesn't work? Your computer, your cell phone, nothing works. So now you're looking at what might be best perceived as a Mel Gibson Mad Max, the first film, where a society is in decline. Now, what's the only thing that we should pay attention to is what can we do now to put into place those technologies that can help lessen or mitigate the circumstances? That's one part of it. The second part of it is people like myself who are looking at, how can I get off the grid? Well, I am off the grid. My house is completely solar and with backup natural gas, and now it's going to be wind and water. Storage of food, major food. Last year, I gave away 3,000 pounds of food to church groups and public food banks because I didn't need it. But I always, every year, I prepare for the next 12 months. And I believe in being prepared. If I don't use it like an insurance, good. I'll give it to someone who is hungry. I'll give it to groups that will see people are fed. I fed a whole school in New Jersey, the poor in that school, with the food I didn't use. But did I think at the beginning of the year in a cavalier way, what, this is, are you stupid? Are you crazy? I can walk downtown. I can get any food I want. Today you can. Today you can. But 2 days ago, all the people living out in Missouri never thought that they would get wiped off the face of the map. And 137 people are dead today. And 3 weeks ago, the most tornadoes in one day in the history of Alabama happened. No one thought it would happen. Well, what we're now in, we're in chaos theory. Nobody can predict with accuracy what's going to happen. So I'm suggesting people start taking measures now before they have to panic. Because the moment everyone wakes up and says, what is happening tomorrow? It's too late. Those are my thoughts. I would like your summation on your thoughts. We will run into the next program, but this is too important not to have you share your thoughts. Lawrence?
Well, thank you. People say to me, it would be like going to back to before their society had electricity. And I say, no, it would be much worse, because those folks knew how to live without electricity. They hadn't become dependent upon electricity. Most of us have. It's the paradox of progress that you become more dependent upon what the latest technology is. And we've really, we've got an opportunity here. We really can do this. And one of the things I'm hoping to do, I'm the annoying guy who won't go away on this. I don't believe that if the House and the Senate do pass bills, that doesn't mean it'll get done. It just means the bill will be passed. But there's a gathering of between 100 and 140 heads of state going to occur next year in Rio in 2012 for the United Nations Earth Summit. I was at the one 20 years ago. I'm going to be at this one. And perhaps we could just make the right kind of splash, because there's not a country on the face of the earth that wouldn't fear losing its electricity. And I don't know how I'm going to do it. But I welcome any suggestions, and a concerted effort would be great. If we bring it up and kind of embarrass these folks into taking some action, we just might save our skins. It may be too late, in the sense that the next climax of solar storms does come in 2012 or early 2013. But there's nothing we can do about that. We have to act as quickly as possible, and if it's not quick enough, well, God help us. But I believe that God helps those who help themselves. I don't mean to go on a religious rant here, but there is something about it. If we take action, we will be far better off.
I agree that we must be proactive and not wait for the government. For those who are waiting for the government, they're waiting in vain. I do not see that the Republicans will surrender the grip they have on being anti-environmental reality. They will continue to deny global warming. There are 12 tipping points, as you know, Lawrence. Four of them will tip no matter what we do. Eight, we still have some capacity to intervene to make life still manageable and with a quality of life. They're in denial of all 12. So it's not easy when you have people who simply refuse to accept a point of dialogue, and yet you have facts that are based upon good science. We will support you in your efforts. And at a time when you get closer to going down there, let me know, and we will do on a worldwide basis. This is a very large audience. This is the largest internet audience in the world. We'll do what we can as a yell out to all those different delegates and the news media to pay attention to what you're going to be offering.
Thank you.
Lawrence Joseph, my guest. I welcome people to share their points of view. I will be doing more on this. This is just the opening discussion. His website is lawrencejoseph.com. His book, Aftermath, A Guide to Preparing for and Surviving Apocalypse 2012. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all very much for listening. We look forward to sharing more on our next program.
Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Taubenfeld.